Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Andrew Olson with the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, and also want to introduce my co-host, Roy Jones.
Good to be with you, Andrew. Roy Jones, Vice President of Development at Mercy Ships, and most importantly, the co-author of Rainmaking, the Fundraiser's Guide to Landing Big Gifts.
Absolutely, and if you don't have a copy of that book, you got to jump on Amazon right now and check it out. Roy has grandkids to take care of, and I got kids to put through college, so, you know, help us out a bit. We're so excited to be with you again today and looking forward to a great interview with our friend Shantae Williams from Panama City Rescue Mission. And before we jump in, I do want to just ask, if you're listening to this podcast for the first time or you're a regular listener and just haven't subscribed yet, hop on over to iTunes after the show and please subscribe to the podcast. And if you are so inclined, also give us a rating. We'd appreciate it. Now, I'd like to do a quick intro. So, Shantae Williams is the Chief Development Officer at Panama City Rescue Mission. Full disclosure, Panama City Rescue Mission is a client of mine. Shantae and I have worked together for a good number of years at a couple different organizations. But Shantae, so glad to have you here. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Before we jump into any deep questions, just if you could take a few minutes and share a little bit about yourself and your background, kind of how you got where you are, that'd be great.
Well, I'm Shantae Williams. I am actually from Indiana originally, but I lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan for, 17 years. Throughout my tenure there, I worked in retail. I worked in banking. In the last 10 years of my career, I worked in nonprofit leadership. Worked for Mel Trotter Ministries as Major Gifts Officer, Corporate Relations Officer. Also worked with Early Learning Neighborhood Collaborative, with the Kellogg Foundation, Doug Maria DeVos Foundation, and worked with a lot of different WECI foundations and different, I'll say, investors in the Grand Rapids area. So I have at least the last 7 years of fundraising experience with Major Gifts, foundations, grants, and also prospect building.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. So one of the things that I was really excited to talk to you about today, because I think this is something that a lot of people in our sector face, is that, you know, you, in the last year, basically, have transitioned from being an individual major gift officer at Mel Trotter in Grand Rapids to really leading an entire development team and playing an even more significant role. I know in your organization, it's a smaller organization, so you probably wear even more hats than that. I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, what you've learned in that transition process of going from sort of a, you know, a team player role at a bigger organization to a leadership role at a somewhat smaller organization. What have you learned and what have your biggest challenges been so far?
Well, one of the things, as I was thinking about this conversation, is I think about the book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And I remember doing that at Mel Trotter because we had such a huge team. It was actually six of us. We had two donor relations officers, a corporate relations officer, a vice president of development, and a senior director of development, and of course our CEO. So we had a robust team to fundraise. But however, you know, when it's the bigger the team is, of course, that you have some dysfunction. So when I was thinking about that, we had read that book. And some of the things we learned throughout that was we all have different techniques and we have different passions and our why. To why we fundraise and why we have a passion for the mission or to serve individuals. And sometimes that's difficult when you work in a team, but what you do learn is the pros and cons of who's good at what and who's just not good. And that's kind of how we used to set up our portfolio with who would be the right person to cultivate and to build a relationship with this donor. So going from six to two, Thurman and I, you have to look at a portfolio and say, I can't really go off of the five dysfunctions of a team. I need to go strictly on, okay, who needs most of the, I'll say, massaging? Who needs really a lot of love right now versus who has been a long-term donor, who are faithful to us, and they're just happy with a thank you note. So my approach had to be a little bit different here, not to mention the culture. Going from Mel Trotter budget at that time was $10.5 million to $1.8 million. So what I'm used to as far as a marketing development communication budget is completely different at a $1.8 million level. So I'm used to having bells and whistles. I'm used to having swag bags. I'm used to having, you know, fireworks, you know. And I could come here and I'm like, okay, maybe I can order some pins. So just learning different ways on how to stretch your dollar and being more of a grassroots fundraiser I believe the big shot, the, you know, had helped me with just saying, okay, intentionally, what's the most important thing for you to focus on right now for your donors? Like, what's your bang for your buck? Because you don't have six folks on the ground with you. Right. It's just really you and one other person and a few board members now. But we just got to that point.
It's interesting, though. You're pointing out the differences, but what I hear you talking about are some of the things that are the same. You know, you nuance some of the techniques, and it's interesting. You're doing the same thing where you're at now as where you were. Talk about that, those things that are the same. How are you prioritizing? What does the meeting feel like? Is the meeting different? I don't know.
Well, here with in Florida and Michigan was a little bit more Dutch Christian Reformed. And then here you have a little bit more of a conservative. Of course, you have a religious, but it's more of a conservative. So the conversation is a little bit different. But here I noticed that we needed more name recognition. So folks knew, like Mel Trotter was around for 120 years. Here we've been around for 47 years. So that's a long time, but that's not a lot of name recognition compared to someone knowing you just like a McDonald's or a Burger King.
Well, and I suppose the budget difference for marketing, right? So the Mel Trotter, what Abby Sladek and marketing team do up at Mel Trotter, I'm sure they have more resources of people and more money to spend. So the awareness can be a lot higher, I would suspect, from that.
Yes. So some of the, and I was just blessed to be able to work side by side with Abby and learn some of those techniques, but a lot of the stuff that we do in-house, like our AA report, now we're using Newport for our newsletter, but for anything else, we're creating pretty much in-house. We're using a local printing company. And there, the marketing, we can literally have a graphic designer kind of come up with something and print it, and they can mail it. Well, here I'm doing mail merges. I have a volunteer group sorting, stuffing envelopes, and kind of figuring out our own timeline. And then I have a volunteer doing follow-up phone calls. So what I have learned is different ways on reinforcing the brand image here, but also just marketing. I'm noticing that the marketing is getting the donors, but as a fundraiser, I'm maintaining that relationship and making sure they understand our mission and purpose. So although we had a huge team there, here, I figured out ways to navigate around that and still try to get the same type of system in place. So a lot of volunteers on site, which is a good thing, because our goal is to have volunteers turn into donors and become ambassadors for the mission. So
it sounds like you really put a fine point on prioritizing your time.
Yes.
Who you spend time with, what donors you're going to go see. Yeah. Talk to me about that.
That is the most difficult because I have volunteering, communication, marketing, development, and board governance now. And then just our operations stuff.
And she cooks the meals on Wednesday, apparently.
Yeah. So what I've done, and I remember looking at prior CEOs and supervisors' calendar and seeing this DNF on their calendar, do not schedule days. So what I've done is intentionally went in my calendar and put in DNS days, and whether I'm focusing on research, whether I'm focusing on emails, phone calls.
I'm stealing that right there. That is good stuff.
So I have DNS days because a lot of times I have an assistant who helps with volunteering and scheduling tours. I want to be present as much as I can, but if I have that time blocked on my calendar, now the whole agency knows, oh, that's Shantae's DNS time. Do not schedule anything, because that means I have a plan for that time. And that's worked out very well. Sometimes it's difficult, but I'm making that a priority because I've seen it work, whether it's grants, things like this, connecting with board, or doing those more higher level time, I'll say concentration activities. So.
Hey, Shantae, you mentioned something at the start of kind of describing your role that, you know, now that you're in a two-person development operation, essentially, you're working very closely with Thurman, your executive director. I think there are probably a lot of development officers who are either new to the field or who are in an organization similar to yours and who are struggling to figure out, you know, how do I work best with my CEO? Maybe there's some intimidation, maybe you know, there's some historical stuff going on where there's not necessarily comfort in partnering closely in that. Talk to me about how you've navigated that and what you've learned.
One of the ways, when I first got here, I came from working with Dennis Van Kampen, who's the CEO at Mel Trotter. So he's very open, but I kind of knew his his walk, his talk, because I worked with him when he was vice president of programs. But what I've learned is the CEO is so busy that you have to kind of make them give you time. You need that face time in order to move your portfolio, in order to prioritize, in order to make sure you're staying on task with what they actually want. So what I do with Thurman is I make sure I have a standing meeting with him. If it's not a face-to-face, I either we text or it's a phone call, and it's a quick focus meeting. It's 30 minutes focused on donors, focused on how do we move, focus on who have you talked to, who have you emailed, and that's to prevent duplication. One of the things I hate is if I'm talking to a donor and I'd be like, oh, I just talked to, and I'm like, I could have called someone else, you know? So you have to communicate that in order to know that, especially when you're a small machine. You have to make sure that you're not duplicating, because we are trying to get as many calls and many face-to-face meetings that we can. And also, it's most important to have those conversations with your CEO about the board, because you need to know, what are the board plans? How's the board feeling about your fundraising strategy? Has the board set new goals that you don't know about? Does our board have any names that you can help me out with? Can they invite me to Rotary? Can they invite me to Aquinas Club? So different conversations like that happen at the CEO level. So just making sure you intentionally get that face time is the most important.
So here's one, and maybe this is a sensitive one, so it's okay to say you can't answer it. But I know in a lot of organizations that I work with, the CEO, and especially somebody like Thurman, who's been in Panama City for at least 20, 30 years, right?
Yeah.
You know, so somebody like that will have close relationships with people who are donors or potential donors. They kind of, from time to time, will say, well, you know, that's my special list. I need to be the only one to engage those donors. And what we often see is that there's a high level of sensitivity with some of those folks to the point where an ask never happens. I'm curious to know if you've faced that yet. And if so, with either of the CEOs you've worked with, you know, how you've navigated around that to really be able to effectively engage those potential donors.
I'll be completely honest with you. You know how I am. Coming into the field I'm in, it's not a lot of African-American women who do this at all. Not definitely for rescue missions, fundraising, not to mention for the Christian world where they believe a man should be in the pulpit, right? So having those conversations with our CEOs is just as important as a man or woman. But one of the ways I come around is I say, you know, you have that long-term relationship with them, but I need to build it. It's very important to have more than one person have a relationship with the donor, because God forbid something happened to you, you lose all of that information that you have in your brain, and that relationship is kind of fizzled, because I would then never know really the attentions that you have with that donor. So oftentimes I'm saying, I'll just come on a call with you. I don't have to talk. I don't have to do anything. I'm just there as a support, and I'm there to get to know the donor. I'm there to get to know the wife. And a lot of times when you're tag teaming, different conversations come up and they get more comfortable. And that has helped a lot with the CEO conversations I've had. I've said, you know, I know you have those two donors that you're just like yours. I get it. But let me just shoot them an email and invite them to a graduation, or trust, or just use the word trust me. It, you know, more hands is better. And that has worked in the past as well.
So I want to pivot us, you know, it's early February when we're recording this, it's the 5th. You know, Roy and I have had several conversations with folks on the podcast, and I think between the two of us, we've probably talked to 80 or 90 other nonprofit leaders in the last month and a half about the 2018 year-end fundraising results. I think what I've heard from so many people is that December was really bad. Mm-hmm. And that there's a feeling like donors have been beat up, and that a lot of donors, for one reason or another, kind of sat out December or took a break in December, changed their giving patterns. I know that, you know, since you came to Panama City Rescue Mission, you've been meeting with a whole lot of donors, and you've been having a whole lot of meetings for the ministry. I'm curious to know just kind of like, what's the pulse in Panama City? What are donors telling you? How are they feeling? What's your experience so far with that?
Our donors here are telling us that they love the new energy. Unfortunately, we suffered from the hurricane October 10th. So that kind of put a pause on our 30-day. And, you know, Andrew, we were doing 150-day $500,000 campaign to restore the mission before Hurricane Michael even happened. So we actually continued with that even throughout that process, and we're in the midst of that right now. But through some of your ideas and through talking to some experts, what we did was we pivoted and mailed to different cities outside of Florida that helped us out tremendously. We're currently at about $430,000 to our $500,000 goal.
That's awesome. That's great news.
Thank you. So we actually had a really good November and December. We had a really good January, and we're looking at having a good February as well. So just doing a few different unique things. I think just rebuilding that relationship and courting. Like I tell Thurman all the time, how did you get your wife? I'm honest. How did you get your wife? That's exactly what I want you to do to donors. I want them to fall in love with the mission and the purpose, and I want them to come and visit us, and then I want to be able to follow up. So those are some of the different things that we're doing here that I believe has helped us. Do we want to do more? Absolutely. But I am just making sure that we're being intentional with conversations. We did, and I think I want to say almost 70,000 short, but for what we're used to ending our year in was really good for us. We're normally about 300,000. So we gained some momentum, actually did a fundraising campaign in Grand Rapids that went well. That went well. So did some unique things that, you know, normal people don't do, and asked for help. You know, went to the CityGate Network and asked for help, had Selena, our area coordinator, come down and do a tour of the mission, talk to churches, and, you know, and was honest. We were honest. We had insurance, but we didn't have sufficient insurance. We're serving more people. We need your help. We have 1,000 more unique individuals here that we're serving. We need your help for. So just being open and honest with our needs has really, really helped a lot.
Yeah, that really opens the door to a whole different conversation about being honest and transparent. Yeah. I don't know if you know it or not, but it just oozes from you. And I really think that's what makes you a good fundraiser. Talk to me about that. Do you think about that, or is it just innate? Is it just natural?
It's just natural. Sometimes I get in trouble for my honesty. Andrew's shaking his head. And then sometimes I don't. I've just learned to remember the why behind it and to be open and honest with not try to paint this perfect picture. Because if we had a perfect picture, we really would need your help. And I look at it that way of saying, we need you because of XYZ. We're not perfect. We're bringing individuals to Christ. We're also serving more people each day. So just telling people what we do, because a lot of times they just don't know. They write a check because they want to write a check, not because they really know what you do. So introducing people, I call it introducing them to my world of either crazy or honesty, and bridging that and saying, I know I'm crazy. I want you to join my crazy. And I think we're on a mission together. So it works.
It's neat. It's very reminiscent, Andrew, of the last conversation we had about just emotionally intelligent, the EQ, mm-hmm. You know, just connecting with people. It just oozes from you, Shante.
Thank you.
You know, I am going to be praying for you. It's such a amazing work there, and to see how you have tackled this challenge, it is a pretty, pretty special thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I think you're right, Roy. I mean, as I hear Shante talk, it really does mirror a lot of what Scott talked to us about with EQ. And I think it's just a really good case study in finding the right people and getting them into the right seats to lead development. I would agree with you. I think, you know, what you're doing at Panama City is just so authentic. And clearly from the results, even in times that, you know, I would say 85% of other organizations saw really bad year end. It sounds like that level of authenticity and transparency really paid well in, you know, motivating your donors to double down and support the ministry even more. That's really cool. So I want to talk about an interesting topic. At least it's interesting to me. I think it's interesting to the two of you, but maybe not. You know, Shante, you and I have done a lot of work with Sean Saunders at Dickerson Baker and Associates. Mm-hmm. To craft a direct mail fundraising strategy that allows us to talk to the donors the way they want to be talked to, regardless of kind of where they sit in your supporter base, and craft some unique strategies to even talk to major donors in the mail. And I think a lot of organizations and a lot of development officers are afraid of the idea of sending mail to their middle donors and their major donors. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to just share a little bit about the experience you've had and what kind of things you think need to be changed and modified to really engage those donors well if you're not able to be in front of them one-to-one.
I've had the pleasure of working actually with Rest Read and with Newport One. And one of the things I really love is the fact that we're able to alter our information to sound like, to sound that is coming directly from us, whether it's photos. I mean, stock images, you have to use them sometimes, but I try my hardest to always submit a picture of someone from the city or a picture of our building. When we went through devastation with Hurricane Michael, I sent the pictures and said, on this letter, put our actual pictures on that letter. I want folks to not know we have devastation, but I want them to see it. And I couldn't have yet to 5,000 individuals by myself. So that's why direct mail is important to me, because I feel like you always end up with a bucket of people that kind of fall through because you can't get to them. It's just humanly impossible. And the crazy thing is people really like to open mail. Some people do, some people don't, but you have those ladies or guys or some millennials even now are saying they love to get mail because they always get emails and text messages. Kind of makes them feel like you're human again when they have to open an envelope. So for us, for our direct mail, it has helped out tremendously. And some of the things that I love is that it's actually touching our lapsed donors. Like Andrew and I have worked on our downgraded donors, just different practices of knowing that donors are given at different levels. And we're getting that response through the mailing, which now we have the data. So a lot of the times, a lot of our mailings are influenced by the data we have in our Razor's Edge or with Blackball, which we wouldn't have if they didn't respond. So a lot of times I look at the mailing system as our collection of data so that we know how to move forward for next year or next quarter or for fall campaign. Because I couldn't do a 5,000 phone-a-thon, but I can do a response to a mailing and get that pocket of people that I know how to get in front of for the fall or for our busiest season. So I think it's worth the investment, and I love Newport One. Andrew knows that.
Well, thank you.
But so it has helped us out a lot here.
You shared with me the last time I was at the mission that, and it's something that I think, at least as far as I know, is unique to your mission. But I think so many organizations that are in the social service space could benefit from this. You talked to me about the fact that you have some of the women who go through your program actually make calls to donors.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So for every gift that come in, whether it's a penny all the way high, even some of the higher gifts, I have our clients call. I have a client that's with me, assigned to me every day from 10 to now 4 p.m. because I need her longer. And I use that as her work therapy. So when I talk to donors, I say, you know, a lot of times folks who come to us come from the service field with addiction or anything like that. So our job is to give them different skills so that they don't go back into that world. So not only are we now training them, but we're giving all those social impact skills and kind of infusing them back into the world. So on their thank you calls, they're thanking them for giving to the mission, but they're also given the opportunity to pray and to share their testimony. So that's a real life way of a donor not hearing from Shantae bugging them again. They're hearing from one of our clients who is a true testament of their investment. And they go a step further with now writing the thank you. And now for every business card that I get at networking events or when I'm connecting in the community, they're sending an email inviting them to tour and have coffee with me. So they have access now to my email, and they're actually able to say, you know, you met with Shantae, she met you at this chamber event, she would love to talk to you more about what's going on at the mission. I'm Becca, I'm graduating from the program, I would love to meet you as well. Come and have coffee with us and set up a tour. So now we have three different ways of touch pointing new prospects, major donors, and churches, volunteers. So we're doing that for each layer of folks to get them re-engaged in the mission. And it's just amazing because they don't know. They're really surprised when someone picks up the phone. They're like, they picked up the phone? I'm like, yep, they picked up the phone. Yep. And we went a step further and we have a development cell phone. So now they can text message. So I got that idea from you when you were like, you have a text message? I'm like, I text message. So now we have a development cell that our clients check in and check out each day with me. They check in and check out a laptop. so they're able to have what they need to help do donor engagement from 10 to 4 every day.
Shantae, the text message idea came from Roy.
Oh.
He was telling me one day that he's got major donors that sometimes only text with him. So I was just
really interesting. It really is interesting. I mean, of course, you know, my sons are in their 30s and I don't talk to them anymore. We just text. And texting really has become the intimate way to communicate. And when you get donors texting you, you're in. I mean, you're part of the family.
That's good. I'm up to that level now, which is good. It feels good.
I just think you're
very wise.
What you're doing with the women in the program is just such a great way to bring the mission and the ministry to life for I'm guessing a lot of donors who might never have the opportunity to step foot on the property, right?
Right.
And I think that's something that a lot of organizations could learn from. You know, they might not all have women in a recovery program, but whatever constituencies they serve, they could probably find ways to bring them a lot closer to the donor and really create a one-to-one connection between the two. Yeah. I think that's really smart.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you touched on this a little bit, but talk to us about some of the other differences you see between donors in the Midwest versus donors in the South.
One of the things is I noticed with what up north is the Christianity is different. Like, we know how we're all Christians.
Okay.
But I really had to understand here the difference with the Southern Baptist, the Christian Reform, the United Methodist, First Baptist Church. So I had to literally break down each one of those because I was just so used to a Christian Reform platform that West Michigan Grand Rapids had. Just understanding that, because that influences a lot of your conversations with donors. And then one of the other thing is our brand image here is different. So Mel Trotter Ministries, being a bigger machine, of course, had a bigger budget. So they were able to explain truly what they did each day. Here at Panama City Rescue Mission, we were still are known as a soup kitchen. So kind of like we're known as the place of holding people in the day, when you do with people at night. Oh, I didn't know you guys do this. So understanding that when you have a 125 staff versus 13 staff, I mean, you have way more people on feet, you know, than here. So I had to kind of get really creative and budget savvy in order to spread the word of what we do. So one of the things I did was they do a lot of newspaper. So in the News Herald, we do a press release about almost everything we do.
Okay.
Which is completely different. Then up north, it was a lot of social media, Instagram, Facebook driven. And then I went, and Tyra Jackson is our communication specialist. Well, she worked for the News Herald. So she has connections. She knows different people in different pockets of the city. So she's able to kind of get us in different areas or have those conversations or bypass an editor. So just getting real creative with, okay, people still read papers here? Okay, I need to figure out how to reach the donors here. And then the other part was, it's more of I like to say Grand Rapids was a little more progressive with women and female leaders and women on the boardrooms. Here is more of a man's world. So with being okay, being my authentic self, but understanding that I don't always need to talk was a shift for me, because a lot of times here, the donor needed me to listen. They needed someone to tell why I invest in you, why we care about you, what are you doing with my money, or whatever the story. So it was the time here has been me listening to, what do you need from us? What do you have questions about the mission? And how can we help you? Versus me going and doing a direct ask saying, we have this campaign coming up, we have this coming up, and we need your help. So that's been a little bit of the difference, which is amazing, because I really feel that it needs to happen at any level. You should just sit there and listen to your donor, because they're going to tell you exactly what organizations they give to, where you rank. I give to you because my mom likes you. I really don't like you. Conversations come up, and then you're able to pivot and kind of plan accordingly once you know where that donor heart lays.
Roy, when she talks, I feel like I'm listening to you the way she's talking about that.
She's living it. It is about ministry, isn't it, Chante?
Yeah,
it's about ministering to them. And sometimes we do that by listening It's interesting to hear you talk about even how you view your own position at times. It's humbling, but I would tell you that, you know, especially even with the senior community, where you might feel like it's more male-dominated, I have found, and I have hired 16 development officers over the last 24 months, and all but two have been women. And the reason is because they were the best for the job. Yeah. And I have found that the donors, whether male or female, really empathize with a female. There's just, and so again, it's a different thing, but I would just encourage you that God has you there for a reason. And it is, it's a very special thing. And I think you'll see this trend, and I'm not sure if you have had a chance to see it personally, because Andrew and I speak at a lot of AFP chapters. You know, I mean, believe it or not, when I used to work for Andrew at Russ Reed, you know, I visited 70 homeless shelters in about a 2-year period. So I've been all over the country.
Oh, wow.
But what we're seeing really is a trend that's very measurable of more women in the major gift field. Even 6 or 7 years ago, it was the majority of a male position. And that has really shifted. I would say the majority of major gift officers today, not necessarily development directors, are women. So it's, again, I think it's a trend of what's happening across the country, and you're right on the cutting edge of it. So it's pretty neat.
Girl power.
Girl power.
I got a house full of them here, so yes.
Yeah.
Andrew's got a house full of them.
But, if they had heard you say that, they'd be right in here shaking their fists. Well, Shante, thank you so much for making time for us today. Really appreciate you sharing and sharing with the community. If somebody's interested in getting in touch with you after they listen to this, what's the best way for people to reach you?
I'll give you my cell phone number. My cell phone number is 616-862-4423. Again, it's Shante Williams, or if you would prefer to email me, it's swilliams@pcrmission.org. I'd love to hear from you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, that's it for today's edition of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. Appreciate everybody listening, and please hop over to iTunes and subscribe if you haven't already, and rate us while you're there. Thanks a lot, everybody.